A Matter of Spirit is the quarterly publication of the Inner Community Peace and Justice Center.
Winter 2016, issue on refugees.
How did we get here? What history can teach us about refugees? By Todd Scribner. Todd Scribner is the Education Outreach Coordinator in the Department of Migration and Refugee Services at the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. His work focuses primarily on the intersection between migration policy, Catholic moral teaching, and American history. The United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees recently estimated that the number of forcibly displaced persons around the world has reached nearly 60 million people, a figure that shows few signs of abating anytime soon. While the civil war in Syria and the rise of ISIS is a significant contributing factor to this increase, conflicts across Africa, including the Congo and Sudan, in Europe, Ukraine, in Asia, Pakistan and Myanmar, and elsewhere have contributed to the rise in the number of displaced persons in recent years. While the scope of forced migration is daunting, the problem is nothing new. One could scan history and find any number of situations in which innocent people are forced from their home in the wake of violence and a rising religious or political fanaticism. The past 50 years alone have witnessed incredible atrocities around the world that have led to the displacement of millions of people. During that same period, the U.S. government and the international community have made important advances in providing protections to displaced populations. Three standard responses, or durable solutions, have helped to frame the international response to refugee crises: voluntary repatriation, integration into the country of first asylum, and resettlement to a third country. Voluntary repatriation is the preferred option, since it signifies that the original cause for displacement has subsided to the point that it is safe for the refugee to return home. However, with the threat of continued persecution or ongoing conflict, it may be best for the refugee to remain in the country of first asylum and integrate into the local community. If remaining in the country of first asylum is not viable because of local resistance, lack of economic capacity, or another reason, resettlement to a third country might be the only realistic solution. One of the early systematic efforts by the international community to respond to the post-World War II refugee crisis came with the passage of the Convention on Refugees, which was approved at a United Nations conference on July 28, 1951. As a consequence of the political, religious, and ethnic persecution during that period, millions of men, women, and children living in Europe were displaced from their homes and forced to flee in search of safety elsewhere. In response, the international community provided protection to European refugees who had been displaced prior to January 1st of that year, and issued the first officially recognized definition of a refugee, which has become the standard mechanism used to determine who can qualify for such status. The convention defines a refugee as a person who, owing to well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable or, owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. The narrowly tailored temporal and geographic limitations of the convention were eliminated with the 1967 protocol related to the status of refugees, but the definition of what constitutes a refugee has remained unchanged. In recent years, the question as to whether or not this definition should be expanded to take into account new realities has arisen. For example, with climate change becoming an ever more present threat, the term climate refugee has become more salient, although according to present international agreements currently in place, it remains a misnomer. In the United States, while the resettlement of European refugees began in earnest in the post-war period, primarily as a consequence of the Displaced Persons Act of 1948, the federal government and voluntary organizations began to coordinate their refugee resettlement work as early as the late 1930s. These early efforts planted the seeds for the public-private partnership that blossomed in later decades as their activities became more closely intertwined. From 1948 to 1950, the U.S. government admitted just over 200,000 displaced persons, primarily through this network of organizations. A similar number were admitted 5 years later following the passage of the Refugee Relief Act. The onset of the Cold War shaped the way in which refugee admissions were handled. At times, political leadership resisted efforts to resettle refugees for fear that it would admit communist subversives that would plot to undermine national security. As often as not, the admission of refugees was viewed as a tool that could weaken Soviet domination in Eastern Europe and further the United States' Cold War objectives. The Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 grounded this Cold War paradigm into law by explicitly providing a Cold War-oriented, ideologically based definition of a refugee as someone who fled from any communist or communist-dominated country or area. Such a framework is evident in the Hungarian uprising of 1956. In reaction to national unrest for political reform in Hungary, Soviet troops launched a crackdown on protesters, killing thousands and forcing tens of thousands more to flee to Yugoslavia and Austria. To relieve some of the pressures of this influx on the Austrian government, President Eisenhower agreed to resettle some 38,000 Hungarian refugees into the United States. In a statement on January 1, 1957, he noted that the admission of these refugees into the U.S. will permit the United States to continue, along with the other free nations of the world, to do its full share in providing a haven for these victims of oppression. His appeal to liberty here and elsewhere is an obvious contrast to the authoritarian and oppressive communist regimes from which they were escaping. Following a nearly six-year campaign, in January 1959, Fidel Castro's 26th of July movement and its allies ousted then-Cuban President Fulgencio Batista. Castro's rise to power and subsequent rule precipitated a significant rupture in Cuban society that contributed to the flight of hundreds of thousands of Cubans to the United States over the next two decades. By 1962, nearly 200,000 Cubans had fled, many of whom were in some way allied with the Batista regime. Emigration to the U.S. slowed substantially for a time following the Cuban Missile Crisis, but resumed with the establishment of the Freedom Flights from 1965 through 1973 that brought in 3,000 to 4,000 exiles every month. Given the large influx of Cubans into the United States during this period, more financial and social support was required, as local support systems were being overwhelmed by the growing demands for assistance. The Cuban government's decision in 1960 to confiscate the personal property of Cubans who fled to the United States strained the resources of local agencies and led the U.S. government to establish the Cuban Refugee Emergency Center in Miami, Florida. The president subsequently commissioned the Director of Health, Education, and Welfare to establish a Cuban refugee program. Further funds were appropriated through the passage of the Migration and Refugee Assistance Act of 1962, which provided direct support for refugees, including education, employment, health, reception, and registration services of Cuban nationals who arrived in Miami. Running parallel to the ebb and flow of Cuban exiles who were arriving on American shores during the 1960s, the United States government launched the war in Vietnam, which set the stage for massive displacement in Southeast Asia. Following the withdrawal of the United States and the communist takeover of Hanoi in 1975, more than a million persons were forced to flee their homes and find safety elsewhere. Many of these refugees fled to surrounding countries, with hundreds of thousands of them eventually reaching the United States. With the growing complexity of the resettlement program, it became important to rationalize the entire process, and in 1979, Jimmy Carter took an important step forward by establishing the Office of the Coordinator of Refugee Affairs. Following the passage of the Refugee Act of 1980, the process for refugee resettlement was more carefully formalized. New institutions were established to help guide these processes, and relations between the federal government and voluntary agencies interested in resettlement became more integrated. The act also undercut the Cold War-based paradigm that had framed refugee resettlement for over a decade and brought the definition of what constituted a refugee in U.S. law in line with the one provided in the Refugee Convention. Although the Cold War framework was eliminated with the passage of the Refugee Act, international politics still played an important role with respect to how the U.S. approached refugee crises, as desperate treatment continued to be given to different groups during the 1980s. Nicaraguans, for example, who were seen as fleeing from communism, were provided a more receptive welcome than El Salvadorans, who were also fleeing conflict and persecution, but one that was recognized as an ally of the U.S. From the end of the Cold War to present, refugee crises have continued to flare up across the globe, from Rwanda in Africa to Kosovo in Eastern Europe. The Rwandan genocide, which began in 1994 and took the lives of at least 500,000 people, led to the flight of as many as 2 million more to surrounding countries. In 1999, up to 1 million ethnic Albanians fled the Kosovo region in Eastern Europe in the midst of a conflict involving NATO and Serbian forces. Elsewhere, countless people have been forcibly displaced over the past 2 decades, only a small fraction of which have been resettled into the United States or elsewhere. Some have managed to return home, but many millions continue to find themselves mired in refugee camps for a decade or longer. Since 9/11, national security concerns have become paramount in the screening and admissions process, particularly as it pertains to the admittance of Muslim refugees. In important respects, contemporary debates over resettlement reflect a similar logic to those advanced during the Cold War. Rather than fearing an infiltration by communists, new concerns have arisen over the admission of terrorists via the refugee resettlement system. Concerns remain that Muslim refugees will use the refugee system to reap terror among local populations. This concern, however unfounded given the expansive security and background checks that are in place to vet refugees, signifies one of the central concerns that work against the U.S. continuing a tradition of welcome to the downtrodden, displaced, and vulnerable. Year of Mercy, Welcoming Refugees by Father Gary Smith. Gary Smith is a Jesuit priest from the Oregon province of the Society of Jesus. He spent 14 years with the Jesuit Refugee Service in East and South Africa and is currently involved in street and jail ministry in Portland, Oregon. Experience. In the beginning and in the end, when talking about mercy and welcome extended to refugees, one probes his or her own experience with refugees. Their grief and hope are touched as they emerge from the whole stinking mess of the refugee plight and flight. In the experience, or lack of it, one begins the dialogue with God on the mercy that Pope Francis invites us to embrace. What am I to do? How am I to welcome? Here's my take on it. I spent 14 years in East and South Africa associated with the Jesuit Refugee Service, JRS, accompanying, serving, and advocating for refugees pouring into those parts of Africa. What follows is about my time with Zimbabwean refugees coming to the JRS project in Makado, South Africa, 60 miles south of the Zimbabwean border. Having described part of my experience, I offer a reflection on extending mercy to the refugee and why it is important for us. Faces. Zimbabwe's children fled, scattered like sparks before the wind, running from persecution and an economy that had gone into free fall. Many did not bother with the proper asylum papers, slipping across national boundaries that cut through the bush between South Africa and Zimbabwe. There are no refugee camps, by law, in South Africa. It could mean crossing by foot or swimming across the crocodile-infested rivers. On the flight, they were frequently victims of thugs who stole their possessions and money. Refugee women were raped. All left loved ones behind in the hope of securing a job in South Africa, enabling them to assist families back home. There they stood outside our office door early in the morning or as they straggled in during the day, tired, dirty, hungry, broke, disheartened, and apprehensive. Most possessed only the clothes on their back and a few precious contact phone numbers. Their faces carried the scars of months of never having it together, never knowing what's next. They had the look of grief that comes from profound loss, family, friends, jobs, and hope. Many had watched loved ones slaughtered before their eyes. There were faces of distress, of anger, of being demoralized, and of being double-crossed by their government. The hearts that were expressed on those faces were deeply troubled, having lost track of the origin of it all, stumbling through the jagged terrain of a broken heart. No one should have to live like this. Mom and daughter. I remember one woman, Scholastica, 35, frail and courageous. By her side, clinging to her hand, was her 7-year-old daughter, a delightful brown-eyed, shining smile girl by the name of Thandiwenkosi, a Zulu word meaning God's love. They had left Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, several weeks before. She was robbed at the border. "Why did you come?" I asked. "To feed my children," she replied. Her goal was to find a domestic job in Makado in order to support herself, Thandiwenkosi, as well as another child who lived with her mother back home. JRS helped to provide for accommodation. As mom and daughter left the JRS offices, I watched them exit our compound, heading to an adjacent road. There they were, mom carrying a piece of luggage on her head and a 5-kilogram bag of cornmeal in one hand, and a few feet behind her was her daughter, double-stepping to keep up, barely managing a bag of vegetables that filled her arms, and cheerfully chatting with her mama all the way. That scene will remain an inner icon of enduring singularity. They were like two sisters who had crossed an enormous desert together, caring and sharing. Mercy. Mercy, born of love, steps forward in the meeting of refugees, in the encounters with the Scholasticas and Thandiwenkosis who walk among them. It could be there in South Africa, but really anywhere in our busted world where we witness long lines of refugees. Our concern and mercy born of love for the refugee calls us to internalize their suffering, a suffering inflicted upon them wrongly and at fundamental levels of their existence. The mercy that Pope Francis invites us to nourish is rooted in the divine. The incarnation and life and death of Jesus are a testimony to God's mercy. The love that gives birth to mercy is such that at the sight of another's unjustly inflicted suffering, we want to eradicate it simply because it exists. Mercy stands at the very origin of all that Jesus practiced. He incarnated that most profound message of the Old Testament. God hears the cry of the poor and the oppressed. The church finds herself with the broken living this same principle. The church must live mercifully. It must incarnate mercy, and it must denounce the causes of the refugee crisis. It must instinctively challenge the suffering to its own body. The church, you, me, must act, because to not act is to deny myself and the best in myself. The place of the church is with the wounded brother or sister Samaritan lying in the ditch along the roadside. It is incumbent upon the merciful person to ask God to show the way to meet the crisis, to choose what Pope Francis benevolently hammers us with all the time. Educate people about the refugee reality. Assist organizations that serve refugees and be open to embracing refugees in our own country. I do not do these things because a gun is put to my head or because it is the pious thing to do, but because the growth of mercy in my heart and my own existence depend upon facing the plight and therefore the heart of the refugee.
The Syrian Refugee Crisis and the Moral Need to Respond by Jen Smyers. Jen Smyers serves as the Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Church World Service Immigration and Refugee Program and has been with CWS for nearly 10 years. A graduate of American University with a BA in Law and Society, BA in Public Communication, and Master's in Public Policy, Ms. Smyers has previously worked with Border Action Network in Tucson, Arizona, and the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. As I write this, the United States is at a crossroads about how we will respond to men, women, and children fleeing unspeakable violence and persecution in Syria. Decisions made now will characterize this nation as one of compassionate heroism or fear-laced indifference. Each and every one of us will look back and wonder what more we could have done in this humanitarian crisis. Origins of the Syrian displacement crisis, Arab Spring, Assad regime, rebels, civil war, and ISIS. In December 2010, the world cheered demonstrators in Tunisia, protests that sparked a wave of public activism fueled by social media and what has become known as the Arab Spring. While these movements have seen the overthrow of governments in Tunisia, Egypt, and Yemen, the responses of other countries show that entrenched powers can impede change for years and even decades. Such is the case in Syria, where the Ba'ath Party has reigned since 1963, and current President Bashar al-Assad responded to protests with military might, waging war on his own people. In March 2011, peaceful protests and a military response sparked a civil war that drove millions from their homes and has resulted in more than 250,000 casualties. Daesh, commonly referred to as Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, and the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, ISIL, has taken advantage of the instability brought on by the civil war in Syria to take control of multiple population centers and wage terrorism on Syrian people, particularly women, children, moderate Muslims, LGBTI individuals, ethnic minorities, and religious minorities, including Yazidis and Christians. At the time of publication, more than 8 million Syrians were internally displaced, and 4 million Syrian refugees were seeking safety in nearby countries and in Europe. Flight to neighboring countries in Europe. Close to Syria, refugee hosting countries have reached their capacity. They have instituted enforcement actions, denied Syrians work authorization, prohibited refugee children from attending school, and forced many people into crowded, unsanitary, and dangerous camp conditions. Thus, as more Syrians have fled, more than 680,000 have applied for asylum in Europe. While the European Union has approved a proposal to welcome 120,000 Syrian refugees among member states, plans have only been made for 66,000 individuals. More countries in Europe are signatory to the United Nations Convention and Protocol relating to the status of refugees, which holds them to ensure that refugees fleeing persecution are provided protection. However, as an increased number of Syrian refugees have sought safety in Europe, countries have increased border controls and screening protocols. Hungary, in particular, has begun the construction of a 13-mile-high fence along its border with Serbia, closed its border with Croatia, and has arrested refugees for trespassing. In the past 5 years, more than 7,000 people have died or gone missing trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. When refugees and migrants cannot access protection by legal means, they will pursue the last resort of taking dangerous journeys. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is working with commercial ships to undertake rescue operations, but desperation leads thousands to risk their lives to find safety for their families. The role of the United States. Few people in the United States seem to be aware of the Syrian refugee crisis until September 2015, when a photograph of Alan Kurdi, a 3-year-old boy who drowned in the Mediterranean as his family sought safety, captured the world's attention. Policymakers in Europe, Canada, Australia, and the United States and beyond began asking how their countries could accept more Syrian refugees. A sharp increase in public support, donations to charitable organizations assisting refugees, and public outcry at the lack of international coordination and leadership followed through September and October. Then, with news of the terrorist attacks on Paris, Beirut, and Baghdad on November 13th, came information that one of the attackers was found with a Syrian passport. Evidence now shows that the Syrian passport was fake, and that all individuals involved in the attacks were French and Belgian nationals, in no way connected to Syrian refugees. Many politicians, news anchors, and anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim groups were quick to establish a narrative that terrorists were masquerading as refugees. While shortly after the attacks, France set an international example by committing to accept 30,000 refugees. The U.S. House of Representatives approved legislation that would grind to a halt the resettlement of Syrian and Iraqi refugees, and 31 governors announced they will not accept Syrian refugees in their states. While governors cannot legally restrict access to their states based on a person's nationality, it remains to be seen how these actions will impact the resettlement of Syrian refugees in the United States. At the time of publication, the United States has only resettled 2,219 Syrian refugees since 2011, paling in comparison to the commitments of other nations, and in particular to the number of Syrian refugees hosted by countries in the region. The Obama administration has pledged to resettle 10,000 Syrian refugees as part of the 85,000 total refugees to be resettled this fiscal year. It is important to note the United States refugee admission program is the most secure in the world, and that refugees are the most thoroughly vetted and screened individuals to travel to the United States, undergoing a 2 to 3 year process of interagency biometric checks, medical screenings, forensic document testing, and in-person interviews with Department of Homeland Security officials. But some politicians are attempting to utilize fear to score political points and dismantle plans to resettle Syrian refugees. One girl's story. Recently, I met a young woman, 17 years old, whose parents are refugees in Jordan. She is a U.S. citizen, but because she is not yet 21, she cannot petition for her parents to join her in the United States. Even if she were 21, the family reunification visa process is so backlogged that the State Department is processing applications that were filed back in 2008. her parents are attempting to navigate the U.S. refugee resettlement program. But since the process takes so long and less than 1% of the world's refugees ever have the opportunity to be resettled, it is unlikely that their family will be reunited anytime soon. The brokenness of the U.S. immigration system, combined with the lack of U.S. leadership to resettle Syrian refugees, has left this young woman's parents with little hope of safety and reunification with their daughter. Recommendations. The United States should resettle at least 10,000 Syrian refugees this year, and plan to resettle thousands more refugees from Syria and around the world in the coming years. While resettlement is not the sole solution to the Syrian refugee crisis, it is a critical act of solidarity that can encourage other countries to keep their doors open to refugees. The United States should also contribute additional funds to the United Nations Refugee Agency and provide infrastructure support to refugee hosting countries so they can continue to provide life-saving protection to Syrian refugees. Each of us has a role. Each voice in support of Syrian refugees that goes unheard is a forfeited opportunity to demonstrate the people of faith want to see this nation on the right side of history. With phone calls to Congress, meetings with national and local policymakers, letters to the editors of our local newspapers, and conversations with our neighbors and congregations, each of us can be the change we want to see. The change that will allow Syrian men, women, and children to realize their bright and resilient future.
Who am I? An unexpected refugee. Robert works for Jesuit Refugee Service as a facilitator of the J.C. Hem Community Health CSLT program at the Zleika Refugee Camp in Malawi. He graduated from the University of Kinshasa in teaching and administration of medical technics. This is his story. For 7 years, I have lived in the Zleika refugee camp in Malawi, a country in the southeastern part of Africa. I survive like any other refugee, struggling to meet the basic needs of my family. I receive a monthly food ration that we get from the World Food Program, a monthly stipend of something around $40 US, and 20 kilograms of rice for my job. However, the psychological wounds from my experience in my home country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, far outweigh the financial difficulties my family and I face in the camp. My story begins in June 2008 in North Kivu, where my wife and I worked as health professionals. I treated 6 soldiers, all of whom had severe gunshot wounds before they were transferred to the main hospital in Goma City. A day later, another group of soldiers came to the clinic to ask me about the 6 soldiers I had treated. They told me that the wounded soldiers were rebels fighting on the side of Laurent Nkunda, who they claim led a rebellion that fought against the governmental military force. Saying that the men I had treated were in violation of the peace agreement, the government soldiers accused me of working on the side of the rebellion. I was then taken to the military camp at Katindo, where I was found guilty of being a traitor. They tortured me for 2 days in that camp until I woke up in Goma Hospital after being found unconscious. I stayed for treatment, then my colleagues and friends who worked at the hospital helped me to escape. While I was in hiding, a group of soldiers came to look for me at my home in Barrier. No one could identify them as government soldiers or rebels. When they found my wife and children, they physically abused them. When my wife cried and shouted for help, she was fatally shot in the back. My children fled in fear, and I have not seen 2 of them since. After getting the tragic news that my wife had died, I was reunited with 4 of my children at the hospital in Goma, where they were trying to get a last chance to see their mother. Before we could see my wife in the mortuary, my friends who worked at the hospital told me that armed people were looking for me
and that I must flee from the city. Later, I found out that both the government and the rebels were hunting me. I feared being arrested and brutally killed, so my family and I fled from the DRC. Our long journey led us to Malawi, where we have lived as refugees ever since. I can't really compare my life here in the camp to my life back home in the DRC. Back home, my family and I had the financial, social, and emotional resources we needed to live a full, happy life. Here, we find it difficult to meet our basic needs. My family is currently in the final stages of the process for resettlement in Finland, where we hope to find a better future. Love Drives Out Fear, Not People, by Mark Rugani. Mark Rugani is a PhD candidate and FYE teaching fellow at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. His research focuses on virtue ethics, integral human development, and the Catholic social tradition. He also serves as chaplain in residence at Georgetown University. Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia, three countries with majority Muslim populations, were the top three countries of origin for refugees in 2014. Russia, Germany, and the United States, three countries with majority Christian populations, were the largest recipients of requests for asylum. The refugee crisis crosses not only continental divides, but religious lines as well. While the international community must always aim to resolve the problems of violence and insecurity at the source of the refugee crisis, we must find ways to fulfill our humanitarian responsibilities and foster a climate of peace, understanding, and appreciation among diverse peoples of all religious professions in our world. Reading reports and editorials in both mass media and social media in the wake of the Paris attacks, one can feel the suspicion, fear, and hostility when encountering the stranger. There is an old saying, familiarity breeds contempt, but in this case, unfamiliarity breeds contempt. We fear what we do not know. For many people in countries receiving requests for asylum, religion quickly becomes a sticking point. Many believe that religion itself is part of the problem, not the solution, to the refugee crisis today. Linking Islam to violence can lead one to misunderstand the core tenets of that religion. Looking more closely at the commonalities of faith traditions can lead to a response to refugees that drives out fear and leads to deeper communication among all peoples. In the scriptures of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, three key themes pervade the narratives of God's love for humanity and call for imitation of that love in our care and concern for others in situations of vulnerability and displacement. Focus on kinship as members of the human family can lead us to a recognition of our common roots and responsibility toward one another. In turn, this kinship can evoke compassion for the suffering of those who leave their homes out of fear and encourage us to open our doors and our hearts in courageous rejection of that fear. These three themes, kinship, compassion, and hospitality, can serve as common touchstones for a mutual understanding by those of diverse religious professions that religion is not the cause, but solution to a crisis that touches us all on a global and personal level. The most personal bonds that tie human communities together are those of family and kinship. The saying, "Charity begins at home," encourages us to attend to the needs of those bound to us by blood and genealogy. But a closer examination of religion opens us to a broader understanding of home. The most recent encyclical of Pope Francis, Laudato Si, subtitled On Care for Our Common Home, invites every person living on this planet to think about the ways in which we share a common responsibility. Francis points out that we not only dwell in and rely on the same gifts of earth, but he calls all people to deeper reflection on the ways in which we are family, dwelling in a common home. In both Christianity and Judaism, we recognize a common ancestry in our first ancestors, Adam and Eve, and the covenant God made with them and all their descendants. Islam, too, recognizes and lauds this common root, where the Quran states, "People, be mindful of your Lord, who created you from a single soul, and from it created its mate, and from the pair of them spread countless men and women far and wide. Be mindful of God, in whose name you make requests of one another. Beware of severing the ties of kinship. God is always watching over you." It is not only the Bible that attests to the common bond and responsibility we have to one another, but Islam as well notes the accountability we have to one another and God to be His family. If we recognize every other human person as a brother or sister in our common human family, it sensitizes us to the needs and sufferings of our kin. In the monotheistic religious traditions of the West, as well as Hinduism, Buddhism, and many other religions, compassion is the hallmark of devotion to divinity. In Islam, one of God's key attributes, Rahman, or compassion, is invoked at the beginning of nearly every surah of the Quran. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Imitation of God is at the very heart of submission to the will of God as a Muslim. So too, in Christianity and Judaism, where God is praised for compassion more than a dozen times in the Psalms, and the label of neighbor given to the Good Samaritan who showed compassion. The religions of the world recognize that identifying and responding to the sufferings of others as one's own suffering is the sign of true religion and doing justice to God and others. Surely, many of us in countries that can offer secure asylum to refugees are suffering ourselves and fearful for our own lives and security. However, it is not in keeping with the righteousness to close our doors to those in need. Moreover, the great mothers and fathers of our respective faiths, including Moses, the Holy Family, and Muhammad, all in their own lives sought asylum and the hospitality of strangers. The scriptures of our respective traditions call us to welcome the stranger. Not only does Islam have its own tradition of hijra, or migration law, to care for and accommodate those seeking asylum, but Christianity and Judaism recall God's concern for those on the margins, widows, orphans, and foreigners, with no standing before the law. Welcoming the stranger opens us up to the same vulnerability experienced by the one seeking hospitality. In opening our door to the stranger, and doing so in concert with those in our own and other religious communities, we can be vehicles of God's compassion to all those bound up to us in the ties of common human kinship. For a third year, my wife and I celebrated the very American holiday of Thanksgiving with students and staff at Georgetown University who were unable to head home for the long weekend. A quick census of origin found we hailed from China, Ecuador, the U.S., Pakistan, Mexico, and many other far-off places. Two of our guests from France, acknowledging the recent tragic events in their home country, raised a glass to toast the gathering. Isn't it beautiful to have an open door? This may very well indicate a way forward for us all as we continue to grapple with the fear, uncertainty, and disorientation that the refugee crisis presents us today. Refugees are not only our guests, but our family, and our houses their homes. May we always open our doors to those unable to go home, driving out fear, not people. As the first letter of John reminds us, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear.
Refugees of Climate Change by Rhett Engelking. Rhett Engelking resides in Washington, D.C., where he works as the director of the Franciscan Earth Corps. Earth Corps is a young adult initiative of the Franciscan Action Network, grounded in the spirit of the economic, ecological, and ecumenical messages of Laudato Si. The term climate refugee has not been officially accepted by the United Nations, but has been characterized as those environmental migrants forced to move due to sudden or gradual alterations in the natural environment related to at least one of three impacts of climate change: sea level rise, extreme weather events, and drought and water scarcity. While the classification climate refugee is not recognized, the forced movement of people due to the impacts of climate change is not a new phenomenon. A sea of empty shoes adorned the Place de République in Paris, France, at the Global Climate March, a demonstration at the 21st Annual Conference of Parties, COP21, that took place on November 30, 2015. This global conference of over 190 countries convenes to review the United Nations Framework on Climate Change, UNFCCC. By taking to the streets of Paris, marchers hoped to urge global leaders to take significant steps to reduce our climate impact. However, to avoid any extra risk after the tragic attacks in Paris earlier that month, the streets were vacant of the thousands of marchers who traveled from every continent to represent those impacted by climate change. Their shoes remained. While initially standing in for those who could not march, the sheer vastness of the abandoned footwear from every corner of the earth calls attention to abandoned people, the voiceless and displaced, who wait as world leaders deliberate over their ultimate fate. Among the collection are the shoes of Pope Francis, who noted in his recent encyclical Laudato Si, "There has been a tragic rise in the number of migrants seeking to flee from the growing poverty caused by environmental degradation. They are not recognized by international conventions as refugees. They bear the loss of the lives they have left behind without enjoying any legal protection whatsoever." Typhoon Haiyan, the strongest tropical storm to make landfall in recorded human history, reached the Philippines in November 2013. Yebsano, the climate negotiator for the Philippines during COP19, urged global leaders to take action shortly after the 195-mile-per-hour winds came crashing on his homeland, displacing an estimated 4 million people. Typhoon Haiyan occurred in the same year as Typhoon Trami, which displaced another 1.74 million. Before commencing a voluntary fast throughout the entirety of the conference, Sano said, "What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness." 2 years after COP19, the madness he described has barely subsided. Lou Arsenio, a resident of the Philippines and activist with the Global Catholic Climate Movement, noted that most climate refugees do not appear on the international radar because they stay within their country of origin as internally displaced persons, IDPs. As a result of the 2013 weather events, Arsenio described a mass migration from the outlying island provinces to the capital and largest city in the Philippines, Manila. The majority of the migrants are indigenous families whose livelihood was directly connected to coastal life. Fishermen who once patterned their lives around a habitable shore are now displaced into tightly packed corners of the city. What is most disturbing is that the refugees have yet to resettle in their original location. These locations have either become permanently inhabitable, or worse still, the corrupt governments have sold off the previously private property to be mined for fossil fuels by companies based in more affluent countries. Because the global climate refugee crisis, which is projected by some to reach 200 million by 2015, cannot be separated from the greed for fossil fuels and the political wars over control of those fuels, no clear political solution is in sight. The events in the Philippines are just one example of the displacement of people all over the world as a result of natural disasters exacerbated by climate change. But amid such impasses, spiritual experiences emerge. In solidarity with those displaced in his home country, Yabsano embarked upon a people's pilgrimage that took him to the most impacted areas of Asia and culminated in a 1,500-kilometer pilgrimage from Rome to Paris, where he placed his shoes adjacent to those of Pope Francis and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Pilgrimages reveal the sacred in the midst of the mundane and offer the experience of the weary traveler with no direction home. No real solution to either the climate crisis or the refugee crisis will emerge until we have the capacity to see ourselves in a stranger's shoes. That stranger may be an activist fighting for climate solutions, a climate refugee displaced from home indefinitely, a pope desperately trying to communicate the moral imperative to take our prayers to action in the midst of so much suffering, or our true self, struggling to walk in solidarity with no clear direction in sight.
A Matter of Spirit is a publication of the Inner Community Peace and Justice Center. Sponsoring communities include Adrian Dominican Sisters, Congregation of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace, Oregon Province Jesuits, Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, U.S. Ontario Province, Sisters of Providence Mother Joseph Province, Sisters of St. Francis of Philadelphia, and Tacoma Dominicans. Affiliate communities include Benedictine Sisters of Cottonwood, Idaho, Benedictine Sisters of Lacey, Benedictine Sisters of Mount Angel, Dominican Sisters of Mission San Jose, Dominican Sisters of San Rafael, Sinsinawa Dominicans, Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Sisters of St. Francis of Redwood City, Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, Sisters of St. Mary of Oregon, Society of the Holy Child Jesus, Society of the Sacred Heart, and Ursuline Sisters of the Roman Union. Our editorial board for this issue was Timnit Gourmet, Gretchen Gundrum, Linda Haydock, SNJM, Vince Herberholt, Tom Holscher, Nick Melee, and Janet Quillian. Our editor for the print edition was Elizabeth Murphy, and layout of the print edition was done by Shannon Hargis. For more information, visit our website at www.ipjc.org.